Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Today on Triad Arts Weekend, you'll find absolutely nothing of interest. That is, unless you're a fan of outstanding brass music, off-Broadway smash hits with original cast members, one of Garrison Keillor's favorite living poets, or cutting-edge contemporary art like nothing you've ever seen before. Oh yeah, and then there's this international singer-songwriter, multi-platinum, multi-Grammy award-winning individual who goes by the name of India. Yes, that's right, India Arie. She'll be here too. Trumpeter Judith Saxton teaches us how to double tongue. Oil City Symphony is back from Broadway and badder than ever. Joe Mills shares the truth about the dark side of libraries. Christine Kerouac captures the beauty, art, and importance of papermen. And India Arie shares life lessons learned from a decade of superstardom next on Triad Arts Weekend. University of North Carolina School of the Arts, School of Music trumpet artist, faculty member, and brass coordinator Judith Saxton is one of the best and busiest trumpeters of her generation. I may be a bit biased. We just happen to have gone to music school together in Evanston, Illinois, where I could hear Judy busily practicing away practically every night until the wee hours at the practice hall on Lake Michigan. But hey, Judy's first solo CD with pianist Alison Gagnon made its way to the entire International Trumpeters Guild membership with over 5,000 folks worldwide. It was selected as the CD to be included in the Guild's March 2011 journal. It's titled Concert and Contest Pieces for Trumpet. Judy's concertized with the Chicago Symphony, Tromba Mundi, and as principal trumpeter with the Roanoke Symphony. In just a few weeks, she'll be performing at the Shenandoah Valley Bach Festival in Virginia. And coming up later this summer, she'll join her colleagues in the Eastern Music Festival Orchestra in Greensboro. Judy's gorgeous trumpet sound and her technical ease with music of all periods from Baroque to bebop make her a highly sought-after soloist and clinician. She was kind enough to schlep her entire kit of trumpets and mutes to the WFDD recording studio to give all of us an insider's look at the brass player's world. Here's an encore presentation from our interview in March of last year. You are a champion of not only traditional, just the great trumpet repertoire, but new works and a composer yourself. I mean, you write music as well.
Very little.
Well, but, you know, just the fact that you have curiosity there, I think really that kind of must enhance your collaboration with composers. You know what you want and can kind of talk in their language and vice versa. What I love about it is it leads us into some of the experimental sounds of multiphonics, flutter tonguing, double, you know, all kinds of effects and mutes that, come about with 21st century composers expecting these unique sounds. And maybe we could sample some of those from you today.
Yeah, absolutely. The first piece I'm going to sample things from is the Jean Rivier, who is the actually composition teacher at the Paris Conservatory for a while. He taught right with Darius Milhaud.
How about that?
It's just a really neat piece combining alto sax and trumpet. I think one of the first ever to do that.
And this is the piece that you said has some theatrical events. You're picturing a silent movie going on?
You know, we do. The music just evokes that sort of era where it's a little over the top, a little vaudeville, and you see this, you know, black and white kind of sketchy screen going. It's a very fun piece that's joyous, and the outer movements anyway are very boisterous and very tongue-in-cheek, you know, that French tongue-in-cheek.
Well, you can talk us through tongue-in-cheek, or you could, you know, a little trumpet says 1,000 words. Then we could hear a little tongue-in-cheek. And which will this be muted?
We are going to – I'll play something open really fast.
Okay.
Just to give you that sound, and then I'll put the mute in and the huge difference. And that's open. And then you just stick in that Harmon mute, which all good jazz players know about.
And just to describe this mute, for those of you who may not be familiar with Harmon mutes, it's metal. It goes right in the end of the bell. And in this case, it's being held in extra firm by a WFDD rubber band at no charge.
You know, as a performer, we try to take the music and really interpret it very closely to the composer's suggestions. And he asked for a Ray Robinson mute, which is basically very similar to a Harmon and also kind of similar to what they call a solo tone mute.
Hmm.
I love this sound. If anybody's familiar with Kurt Weill, this is the era of Kurt Weill sound that's evoked by this mute. And again, that kind of goes along with this genre that we're performing in.
Beautiful. Boy, that really creates a mood immediately, doesn't it?
Oh, and, of course, you put in a little extra vibrato
because
it just fits with the sound.
It does, you know? and a fast vibrato, too. It's nothing thick and romantic. It's got to be. Great. So Jean Rivier, the Concerto for Alto Saxophone and Trumpet, and Tamor Sullivan will be joining you on Alto Saxophone. Very, very fine saxophone player.
Thrilled to collaborate with him on this. And my pianist is Alison Gagnon, who I'm also thrilled to work with.
Judy, what else?
I got a little piccolo trumpet.
Oh, piccolo trumpet. Perfect.
So the opening of the recital is going to feature the sparkling tones of the piccolo trumpet. And Allison's going to be playing harpsichord. Saxton Rose, our new bassoon professor, will play the continuo on bassoon. And our soprano soloist, who will, I think it's some of the most amazing sound in the universe, is piccolo trumpet and high soprano. It's so beautiful how it dovetails together. But I'll just show you the difference in sound of the piccolo. The piccolo is literally the Italian word for small. So this trumpet is half the size of my B-flat trumpet. And so it actually plays twice as high, not as easily as you might think. It's just depressing a valve.
But is it the same mouthpiece? Did you switch mouthpieces?
I did switch mouthpieces, mostly only because I have a cornet shank. It's a different size for it to fit in.
I got you.
But some people play the exact same mouthpiece. Many people change.
All right, and this is from the Scarlatti?
Yeah, this is from, and I apologize, I did study voice and took languages, but I'm not sure. I think it's Si Riscaldi il Tebro. One of the movements, the interior movements of the Scarlatti. There's seven of these Scarlattis. I'm going to do three. This alternates between the voice and the trumpet, but the neat thing, the ones we chose have a lot of voice and trumpet playing at the same time. We love that sound.
And Carol Ott will be joining you in this performance?
Yes, and she's a former horn player.
Perfect.
And, of course, she's the conductor of the Winston-Salem Symphony Chorale, I think is the name.
Right, and a fine professor at UNCG.
Right.
All right, take it away.
Okay. So it's just very light and bright.
Play me a high note, though.
Of course, of course. I'm trying to think if this one has a bunch, but I'm just going to play a scale up to a high note. And that's kind of the workable range of the – actually, this is the A side of the piccolo. The piccolo is so small that I can change the key of the instrument simply by moving a slide 1 inch. I can change the entire key of the instrument.
How about that?
Very fun.
Beautiful.
So there's some sparkle, there's some different mutes, and there's just a lot of different colors and different eras in the performance and different countries and different instruments.
Judy Saxton, thank you so much for stopping by with all this equipment and all these trumpets and all those bags. I'll help you out to the car.
Thank you.
My thanks to University of North Carolina School of the Arts, School of Music trumpet artist, faculty member, and brass coordinator Judith Saxton. That interview was originally recorded on March 30th, 2011. Judy's new solo CD with pianist Alison Gagnon is Concert and Contest Pieces for Trumpet, and it's available for sale. You'll find links on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. You're listening to Triad Arts Weekend on 88.5 WFDD. I'm David Ford. Well, we'll put down our Harmon mutes and piccolo trumpets for just a minute. We're off to the actor studio next with a view from the director's chair as well. Well, it's time to get ready for Slamming Doors, Mistaken Identity, Double Entendres, Rapid Fire, Office Banter, and a marathon of physical comedy. The festival stage of Winston-Salem's production of Hatchet Man by David Wiltsy is here. The golf magazine Putts has fallen prey to a corporate takeover, and the band of misfits employed there are now working overtime to keep their jobs. Hatchet Man runs through May 27th with evening performances at 7:30 and 8, and weekend matinees at 2 o'clock in the Haynes Brands Theater in Winston-Salem. You'll find links to the complete festival stage performance calendar on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. Back in January, Festival Stage of Winston-Salem kicked off its second successful season with a revival of the off-Broadway hit musical Oil City Symphony. The theater was transformed into a high school gymnasium for the show, where four graduates of the 1960s were reunited to give a concert in honor of their beloved former teacher. The festival stage production featured two of the four original cast members and co-creators, Mary Murfitt, who also directs, and composer-performer Mike Craver. They both dropped by WFDD along with Steve Umberger to talk shop. Here's an encore presentation of our interview.
Mark Hardwick and I started out, we were going to have a sort of Ferrani and Teicher thing. We're both keyboard players. And that's how it started. We were going to do some Zez Confrey things. And then Mark asked Debbie, who had been in Pump Boys with him, to come in because she played the drums. So it turned into a trio. And then we decided we needed another chick, so we got a violin player.
I think a lot of people don't realize the organic nature of some of these productions.
It was total give and take because we started out with 15 minutes and we thought, well, you know, we got to have a little more than that. Then we got 30 minutes and we thought, well, we're an act now. But then we got a showcase and we added 15 more. So we had 45, but that still wasn't enough. Then about 6 months later, we did a Christmas show and added, say, I don't know, 15 minutes more.
Yeah.
And then we got our gigs in Dallas and Baltimore, Preed in New York, and added 15 more, and we had 90 minutes. So, and it was very organic that way.
How does the story change throughout that period, though? You start with a 15-minute chunk. And Mary, you were in the original production?
I wasn't in the very first group of it, like when they brought in a violinist. And then she dropped out of the project, and then they went looking for somebody else. They needed somebody who could play the violin. They listed like four instruments you could play, and I happened to play all of them. So I actually auditioned for Mike and Mark and Debbie, then also got involved in, you know, writing some of, we would write our own character bios and would come in and we'd give each other assignments like, let's come in tomorrow and we're going to say why our instrument is the best, or and then we'd come in and we'd do them for each other, and if it made us laugh then it stayed in.
So there's that whole almost like an SNL or Second City quality to it.
Well, it's very collaborative. I mean, and that's the great thing about musical theater is that you can't do it in a vacuum. And when you get to the performance part of it, you've got to have a lot of people that are believing in this idea. I mean, designers, directors, you know, lighting. All of a sudden, you've got everyone collaborating on it. And that's what's really great about it. And that's what was fun about doing Oil City. It was done with such joy. We had such a good time doing it. And it stays with the piece. It somehow seems to be in there now.
It's rare when you get the original actors and musicians and the composers involved in a production right here in Winston-Salem.
Yes, it's a really unusual thing. And I told these guys after I saw one of their first run-throughs, I said, we are so lucky to have all of you here, because I had known about the show, but I'd never seen it. You know, it's a little legend, really. You know, it's been around for a lot of years, and it's been done off and on through the years.
What was the first production? 87?
87, yeah. Off-Broadway.
Off-Broadway, yeah. At Circle in the Square. Wow. And there's a cast album of it, you know, so I knew of it. And I've known Mike for a long time. And then, of course, we did. Mike and I have worked on Lunch at the Piccadilly, which he wrote the songs for over the last...
Lunch at the Piccadilly.
See? It's tuneful. And so, you know, we've done that several times over the last 4 or 5 years, and we did it last year for Festival Stage in Winston. And it went really well, and people liked it, and a lot of people came to see it. So we're, you know, as you build a theater, you're looking to build on those threads, those things that you start. So one day I said to Mike, what about Oil City Symphony? So that was the beginning of the idea of getting it into Winston. And then I talked to Mary, and we just engineered for them both to be involved in this and for her to direct it. So they bring all of this separate and collective history. When you watch these people perform, I mean, it's extraordinary. The levels of, certainly the musicianship is just terrific. And then the levels of reality, you know, this is a really interesting piece because it's not a typical show with a plot that you follow. There is dialogue, but it's all in the framework of a recital. So it doesn't seem like a typical story at first. But there are lots of dimensions and dynamics behind the music. So in my experience, it's unique.
Getting acquainted is fun when you're done knowing you and me.
Hi, I'm Mark. I'm 32 and my eyes are blue. I am currently the minister of music at the Mount Zion Presbyterian
Church. It sort of created
Church.
A new template for Aquarius, what they called environmental theater.
Hi,
like before Forever Plaid, we were before, you know, a lot of these shows, and it was a high concept show. There's not much of a book to it, not a whole lot of dialogue, but the concept is so strong. So the whole package, the lights, the costumes, the sound has to be in a particular way, I think, for the show to be the best it can be, and to be, you know, truly funny without being mean-spirited funny. It's not sarcastic. It's not patronizing. It's parody, which is kind. Parody is usually, it's an homage to something, whereas sometimes these other shows, they'll get a little snarky, or it's a little goofy, or it's a little, I don't know. But this is true. We try to make do it as real as we possibly can.
Because the framework of it is musicians, people in a small town, returning to their high school to do a recital. And they're music students, but they're not professional, quote unquote, in the way that maybe they would like to be or thought they would be. So you have that element to it. But in the play itself, the audience is going to see and hear really good musicianship.
It's all on you, Mike. I mean, the music's not there, it falls.
Yeah, and we always have one person every run who comes up and says, "You guys weren't really playing those instruments, were you?" I just want to warn everybody now, we really are,
yeah.
For better or worse.
That interview originally aired on January 31st, 2012. The festival stage production of the off-Broadway hit musical Oil City Symphony kicked off their second successful season in the Haynes Brands Theater in downtown Winston-Salem. My thanks to cast members and co-creators Mary Murfitt, who also directed, and composer-performer Mike Craver. Festival stage director Steve Umberger joined in the fun. Going on right now at Festival Stage, the hilarious farce Hatchet Man by David Wiltsie runs through May 27th with evening performances at 7:30 and 8 and weekend matinees at 2 o'clock in the Haynes Brands Theater in Winston-Salem. Hatchet Man is appropriate for children 13 years of age and older, and you'll find links to the complete Festival Stage performance calendar on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and when we get back from this short break, it's poetry, art, and India RE. I hope you'll stay with us. You're listening to Triad Arts Weekend on 88.5 WFDD. I'm David Ford. As always, there's lots going on in the art scene here. After heralding in today's show with trumpets and sneaking backstage with the creators of the off-Broadway hit Oil City, I'd say it's about time to dial it back just a touch with a little poetry. Press 53 author Joseph Mills says on one level he writes poems to try and make sense of the world. He likes to quote the poet Mark Strand, who says he writes poetry to prove he's paying attention. A Prairie Home Companion's Garrison Keillor has been paying attention to Joe's raw, honest, and oftentimes downright funny poems about being a dad, family life, his children, and life's simple pleasures. Over the past couple of years, Garrison has read three of Joe's poems on his program, but today we'll get to hear Joe's creative work straight from the horse's mouth. He'll be reading from his new book of poems, Sending Christmas Cards to Huck and Hamlet, in just a minute. Then later on Triad Arts Weekend, after our little poetry, wine, and cheese, it's time for this. I began my interview with India RE by telling her about a driveway moment I had about 10 years ago while listening to KUT radio in Austin, Texas. Cruising down Mopac Expressway, I heard a song on the radio that was so uplifting and positive, I just had to park the car, rummage through the glove compartment for a pencil, and jot down the name of the song and recording artist. The artist was India RE, of course. The song was her first big hit titled Video, and while I confessed to her that ultimately, for whatever reason, I never got around to buying her CD, India didn't seem to mind at all.
It really just depends on whatever feels good in my soul.
That's so cool. Thank you for telling me that. I appreciate that it moved you because that's my intention. Like, I want to entertain people too, but I want to touch people emotionally. And for me, music is a spiritual work. So if it catches a person's attention or makes them think of something in a different way, that's what I pray, literally pray into my music. So I really don't mind that you didn't buy it. I just like that you had your driveway moment.
Stay tuned for my conversation with the lyrical, poetic songwriting of international recording artist India Ari. That's coming up later on today's show, but now it's time for some poetry of a different sort. Poet and educator Joseph Mills is a faculty member at the University of North Carolina School of the Arts, and he holds the Susan Burris Wall Distinguished Professorship in the Humanities. Pulitzer-nominated award-winning author Anthony Abbott calls Joe's latest, Sending Christmas Cards to Huck and Hamlet, quote, one of the most original collections of poetry I have ever encountered. On May 24th at 12:30, Joe will be at the Central Library of the Forsyth County Public Library System in Winston-Salem. Joe stopped by WFDD to talk about Sending Christmas Cards to Huck and Hamlet. Here's part two of our conversation.
If librarians were honest, they wouldn't smile or act welcoming. They would say, you need to be careful. Here be monsters. They would say, these rooms house heathens and heretics, murderers and maniacs, the deluded, desperate, and desolate. They would say, these books contain knowledge of death, desire, and decay, betrayal, blood, and more blood. Each is a Pandora's box. So why would you want to open one? They would post danger signs warning that contact might result in mood swings, severe changes in vision, and mind-altering effects. If librarians were honest, they would admit the stacks can be more seductive and shocking than porn. After all, once you've seen a few breasts, vaginas, and penises, more is simply more, a comforting banality. But the shelves of a library contain sensational novelties, a scandalous permissive mingling of Malcolm X, Marx, Melville, Merwin, Millay, Milton, Morrison, and anyone can check them out, taking them home or to some corner where they can be debauched and impregnated with ideas. If librarians were honest, they would say, no one spends time here without being changed. Maybe you should go home while you still can.
Oh, the power of ideas, the power of knowledge.
Exactly. And once you know something, you can never not know it again. So,
I love how you speak to with that line of where they can be debauched and impregnated with ideas, that just the engagement element you're bringing forth here. It's not a one-sided deal when you pick up a book.
No, it's not.
So many poems, so little time. I was going to jump onto Ode, though. Is that all right with you?
That is fine with me. Okay. Ode is an important poem for me. So
yeah, I've been saying this more and more, I guess, as I get older. It's a cliche. I take time to smell the roses. I get a lot of pleasure out of the little things in life, the things you see every day.
And I think that's, in fact, for me, Ode is an important poem because Ode is kind of the answer to why I write. And this is kind of why I do it. The irony of that is Ode is the kind of poem that I said I would never write when I was younger. You know, the younger me was like, oh, a poem about writing poetry that's so narcissistic, that's so egotistical. I'm never going to do that. just like I was never going to have kids or get married or own a house or have a regular job. And it turns out all those are pretty great, you know, and there's a reason for them. So this is called Ode. He says, compose an ode, a praise song to something ordinary. And I decide to first write down possible subjects. Coffee, donuts, the morning air, the smell of onions and butter frying, the purple hyacinths by the garage, the jeans with the holes in the knees. And I add to the list as I walk around the house, the neighborhood, the day, until I've filled my notebook. So I buy another. And the first thing I write in it is new notebooks and old cashiers who call you honey. And I fill that one, then another, and the sun descends, and I put that in. That takes dozens of pages, as the light seems to change everything. And the sun itself changes as it dissolves against the horizon. Then the gloaming and the thickening darkness. Then the glowing of houses, blue windows, bike lights, fireflies, stars, and smelling somebody's pipe and wood smoke, and hearing voices and cheers from the nearby ball field, and someone's guitar, and drinking wine that was given to you by a friend, and sitting on a screened porch, swinging a pen back and forth, noting as much as you can, and trying to get some of it down, just some of it, before it's too late.
Life is short.
Yes, it is. And you want to pay attention. You want to get some of it down before it's too late, before these things are gone.
I like one of the references in there just grabbed me in terms of how you respond to someone calling you honey, the cashier calling you honey, because that speaks to me, to my own kind of journey in life. Initially, I didn't get that because I didn't know the person and it made me feel a little uncomfortable. But now I love it. And I don't know what happened between then and now, but it's just kind of this embracing, just comfortable with that little moment and not questioning it so much.
Yeah, and I think, you know, my wife, when she was growing up, spent a lot of time in a small town in England and didn't like it and couldn't wait to get out of it and kind of badmouthed it to me of, oh, I grew up in a small town. And then she took me there, and I loved it. It was totally charming and because I wasn't from there. And I went to a place to get, you know, tea and a pastry or something, and the woman said, you know, that'll be 50p, love. And I thought, oh, she called me love. That's so cool. And so when we came back, and the waitresses do the same thing, here you go, honey, here you go, dear. You know, I love that. So, and the younger me would not have loved that.
he says, write this ode. Who is he? Is this you? Is this a father figure? He says, compose an ode.
You know, a lot of times my poems will be about teaching and writing as a student, and my perspective will shift around between being the student and being the teacher.
Well, nothing in this book seems to bring that out, that dynamic, that shift of perspective more than Mean, where you're suddenly in that classroom seat as the student, and then you're behind the lectern as the teacher in this case. Well, one thing that's beyond doubt, though, is that you are Mean in this poem.
I am Mean. This poem is called Mean. For almost an hour, they've argued about what the poem means. And although they've reached a consensus, treating interpretation as a kind of democratic exercise or statistical problem, now, at the end of class, they turn to me for the answer. They're sure I know. If I say I don't, they won't believe me. And they shouldn't. I do know what the poem means to me today. But I also know that it used to mean something different several years ago when I first read it. Some poems are fish, finning away when you try to grab them. But if you can hook, net, and gut one, you can eat it. Once. Some poems are greased pigs, squirting free, leaving you breathless, dirty, hands on your knees, shaking your head at their dexterity. Some are chameleons, appearing to be whatever you want or need them to be. I could point out a poem is miraculous in its animal shape-shifting, not a statue covered with a tarp to be yanked off at a key moment. I could say it means no more than a tree does, or a sparrow, or a brick. But although this may shift their attention from what the poem means to what I mean, it's the kind of response that makes people say they hate poetry. You want to know what the poem means, I ask? They nod. I understand that, I say, as I close my book and turn away to wipe the board clean. Most grumble, annoyed at this refusal to do my job. Some suspect it's another teacher trick. A few are afraid I'm just being mean. And one girl stares as if I'm an animal who is moving just outside of her reach.
Part 2 of my interview with poet and educator Joseph Mills. Coming up on Thursday, May 24th at 12:30, he'll be at the Central Library of the Forsyth County Public Library System in Winston-Salem and reading from his highly acclaimed new work, Sending Christmas Cards to Huck and Hamlet. This is Triad Arts Weekend, and we'll be right back with my interview with India Ari. She's the ultimate life learner, and her life's an open book. Next, when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. Well, after all that peaceful poetry reading with our good friend Joe Mills, some might question the wisdom of shifting from Huck and Hamlet to hip-hop. But India Ari is not your average hip-hop artist by any stretch of the imagination. In fact, if you're a music fan but a hip-hop skeptic, I'll bet the power, variety, musicianship, and intelligence behind my next guest's music might just surprise you. Back in 2001, singer-songwriter India Ari's debut album, Acoustic Soul, hit the airwaves and quickly went multi-platinum. We're sampling from the first song on that album right now. It's called Video, and it deals with acceptance and a young African-American woman learning to love herself for who she is inside. She sings, I'm not the average girl from your video, and I ain't built like a supermodel, but I learned to love myself unconditionally because I am a queen. 10 years ago, I heard those words for the first time on my car radio and ended up experiencing a driveway moment. I ripped open the glove compartment, rooted around for a pencil, and quickly jotted down the name of the song and the artist. I was struck by the singer's raw honesty and strength and was determined to own that tune. Fast forward to 2012, and that 20-something singer is now in her mid-30s, and India Arie's music continues to speak powerfully to the interconnectedness of us all. You may know that she's a Grammy Award winner and NAACP Image Award honoree, but did you know India Arie has performed for presidents, Nobel Peace Prize ceremonies, and she stands with her peers as an activist for global health and human dignity? In that global spirit, her most recent music includes collaborations with Turkish singer superstar Sezen Aksu, and her new CD will feature Israeli singer-songwriter Idan Reichel. That CD, titled Open Door, is due out later this fall. But in the meantime, you can check out a just-released video performance of one song from the album. It's titled Gift of Acceptance, performed by Idan and India in her home in Atlanta, Georgia. You'll find a link to that performance on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. Well, last month, India Arie performed a sold-out concert on the North Carolina A&T State University campus in Greensboro. Prior to her arrival in the Triad for that performance, she spoke with me by phone from her Atlanta home. Here's some of that conversation. Something's got to change. Don't be offended, this is all my opinion. Ain't nothing that I'm saying long. This is a true confession. How have you changed as a performer in the past 10 years? And maybe just start there.
That's loaded for me because music for me is a spiritual work, and it truly, truly is. I pray for songs. I pray for song titles, song concepts. I pray for melodies. I pray intention into my songs. If I'm writing something for someone else, I pray that God will show me what they want to say in the best, like, concise, most possible way. I pray that my music will touch people. Like, I literally pray this as I'm writing and as I'm singing. I pray before I go on stage. Sometimes I pray on stage, like it just comes out sometimes. But I used to try to hide that. I used to try to hide it because I felt like, you know, like I would be somehow telling people too much. And I didn't want to be cutting myself off from middle America or the masses or whatever people like. Like I didn't want to be too esoteric or spiritual or religious or whatever.
Sure.
And over the year, like I was 25 when video came out, and now I'm in my mid-30s, so I've grown a lot as a person. I've grown a lot in my spirituality. I've been around the world. I've had conversations with all kinds of people. I think I've talked to all of my living heroes, Alice Walker, Maya Angelou, Oprah, Stevie Wonder. Like, I've been able to talk to them about real things. And so I've learned what it means to just be yourself and the power in it. So I said all that to say that as a performer, I don't hide anything. I don't hide anything. I tell people how I feel when I get on stage. I tell a lot about my personal life. I tell what the songs are about more than I ever did. And I also am more expressive with my body, too, because that's been a challenge through my life. Like, my physical expression surrounding, like, just my womanhood and all of that has been a challenge all my life. So in the past 3 years, I've been dancing, which is something I never thought I would do. I never thought I would do it in front of anyone. And now I dance so hard at my show that I have to change my dress. In the middle of the show, I change my clothes. Little girl with the pressing curl. Age 8, I got a Jerry curl. 13, and I got a relaxer. I was the source of so much laughter. 15, when it all. Listening to you sing, I'm just floored by, I guess the tune I just heard before I came on was I Am Not My Hair. It was a live performance you did. Just amazing intonation. Did you ever have to work through that, or is that just something that you had starting off? I know this is the technical aspect of performing, but what all has gone into that, and how has that evolved over the last decade? Thank you. I never took voice lessons until very, very recently, but my mother's a singer, like I said, and I always heard her sing, so I guess I knew I had that neurological pathway, mind-body connection that singers get. Be able to make a note with your physical apparatus, be able to make notes you hear. So I got that from my mom just from singing forever. But then also, technically, and it's not just me, like every singer I know always sings. Like you washing the dishes or you're walking around the house and you hear a noise or you hear somebody do something and you try to duplicate the noise of the door, or whatever, or you hear somebody sing something and you got to sing it like them to see if you can do it. But singers always sing, and you start to train yourself over the years. Right now, I just started taking vocal lessons because I learned that I was doing some things wrong, and also because I met a singer who has a deep voice like mine, and she could belt way, way high, and I was like, if she can do that, I can do that. So I started taking voice lessons to figure out what that is, and I slowly am getting it. Like, it clicked in one day when I was crying, and I was like, I didn't wear my voice out, so what was I doing?
What were you doing right with your diaphragm or whatever?
Yeah, and I figured it out. So I Am Not My Hair, the Testimony Volume 1 and Testimony Volume 2 are like these companion pieces, and there was a three-year break between my first two albums. Acoustic Soul and Voyage to India were back-to-back. There was a three-year break, and then there was Testimony Volume 1 and 2. So with Testimony Volume 1 and 2, I was in that process of learning to use my voice another way. And a lot of the belting and stuff that you hear on I Am Not My Hair was new to me. Like, I couldn't do it before that. So thank you for noticing.
Shave it off like a South African beauty. Got it on lock like Bob Marley. You can rock it straight like Oprah Winfrey. If it's not what's on your head, it's what's underneath. Say, hey, I am not my hair. I am not this skin.
Do you feel like a certain power through that vulnerability? I mean, power in the best sense and an empowering sense?
Yes. There's nothing more empowering than when you have nothing to hide. When you're trying to hide a bunch of stuff and you got a bunch of like little issues and stuff like that, it constricts you. You can express just a certain way. When I don't feel like I have a bunch of stuff to hide, I allow myself to be in the flow of the moment, and whatever comes out just comes out. It is empowering in the most honest sense of the word.
I'm just wondering how that might translate into the way you phrase something or how you project or your interaction with the audience or any number of things that I'm not a singer-songwriter, but I would imagine that does give you freedom to do something improvisational or something new.
Well, I mean, there is that too, like the improvisational nature of singing. I'm going to try to say this as simple as I can because I've never said this before, but it is coming to mind right now. Mm-hmm. I went to Turkey, and I got to hang out with Turkey's biggest star. Her name is Sezen Aksu, and she recorded on my last album. We did a song together called The Cure. So when I was there, she taught me the basics, like the basic understanding of how music is expressed over in Turkey or like in Indian culture. I don't know, maybe Middle Eastern culture as well. And it's like we have intervals, like whole note, half note, whole note, half note. In Turkish music and in a lot of Middle Eastern countries, there's 9 tones between each note.
That's right. The notes in between the cracks of the black and white keys in the piano, those microtones.
Right. So all that sliding and stuff. And when you think of being improvisational as a singer, there's so much in between the notes that you would never try to sing if you were afraid what people were going to say.
Mm.
Not just microtones, but there is that when you think of black music and the way that black singers slide stuff, like we slide and move. There's that too, but then there's also that other stuff, like the backstory, the emotional backstory that is the notes in between the notes of your story. And like there's all of that. But then also something that you would have never known to ask me, and what is also going to come up when we do this show in North Carolina, is that I, in the past 2 years, went through a very intense and profound spiritual shift where my life got to the point where I didn't like the way it looked so much that I stopped doing everything that I was doing and started doing all new things that included the people that I worked with, where I lived, how I approached my music. I actually thought I was going to retire, and I was looking at schools. I was going to go to school for philosophy and creative writing, and I had narrowed it down to 5 schools. I was going to quit because I didn't like how it felt doing things in the music industry. I liked being a musician, but I didn't like the music industry. So through a lot of prayer and meditation, I realized that there was a difference between the music and the music industry, and I made a promise to myself that I was going to make the music that I want to make.
This is Hawa Hazel.
So what came out of that is that I am expressing myself lyrically in a way that I never had before. Like I would try to hide the spirituality inside of the music. And now I just say things like very straightforward. A lot of what the kids are going to hear at North Carolina A&T is my new album, Open Door.
I'd composed all of it with the artist from Israel named Idan Reichel. And so I sing in Hebrew, which I never thought I would ever sing in Hebrew. I always thought maybe Spanish or French, but never Hebrew. So
that's an expressive language.
It is very expressive, and I love the way that it fills all of my creative desires and my mental, like the mental puzzle of it, like all of it together is so fun. The songs that are in English are written around classical Jewish melodies, so that's fun too, with English lyrics. So there's a song on Open Door called The One that is about the interconnectedness of all people and all things. I would never even say anything like that out of my mouth in an interview or in a song or anything because I'd be afraid that I would somehow incur people's judgment in a way I didn't like. But now I sing this song. It's the song that we open the show with. And I say, this entire show tonight is about the oneness and the interconnectedness of all people and all things. Can you imagine that you're more connected to the person you're sitting next to than you thought?
Sing things from life. We want peace, love, and prosperity. But can we give up? I need to be right. Give the world a present. Give the gift of your acceptance. Give the world a present. Give the gift of your acceptance. And you can honor mine. They call you Israeli and they call me American. I look at you and I don't see your country, I just see my friend. I pray we're in each other's lives for a long, long time. Cause I honor your choices and you honor mine.
My thanks to India Ari. She spoke with me by phone from her home in Atlanta, Georgia. Her April concert on the North Carolina A&T State University campus in Greensboro was a standing room only event. And in keeping with India's generous spirit, the opening acts for her show were performed by a group of talented A&T student dancers, singers, and actors. India Ari continues to stretch herself personally and artistically, and her musical growth can be heard this fall with the release of her new CD titled Open Door. It's a collaboration with Israeli singer-songwriter Idan Reichel. If you go to our website, you'll find links to a new video of the two artists performing the first song on the album titled Gift of Acceptance. The video was shot in India Ari's home in Atlanta. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Let's see. We've had classical music, musical theater, poetry, and a little pop. What am I missing today? Oh, yeah. Art. Canadian Prairie-born artist Christine Kerouac has had her media installations, performances, and videos exhibited in both galleries and film festivals throughout Canada, Paris, Lisbon, London, Ireland, and most recently Cairo. Beginning at 6 p.m. on Sunday, May 20th at the Delta Arts Center in Winston-Salem, Christine's beautiful new research and photo-based project Papermen comes to the Triad. Papermen is a series of 20 large-format black-and-white images of the hawkers who sell the local Winston-Salem Journal in the city streets. The exhibit raises compelling questions about what constitutes portraiture, community, and the value of the art object itself. You'll find several images from the show on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. In the meantime, here's part one of my conversation with artist Christine Kerouac.
What's interesting about this project for me is that the technical aspects of what I ended up actually making, you know, collaboratively with a team that I put together actually, was only part of getting this work made. And the first part was that I had to reserve my own skepticism and fear and trepidation and take a chance on approaching someone who may not speak to me, who is very skeptical of what my motivation is. And I've done other projects similarly where I've had to engage someone fairly quickly and get something from them and establish a sense of trust. I think what made it successful was that over the course of the last 2 years, I kept going and making sure that they knew I hadn't forgotten about this. Some of these guys have had stories done about them before in the paper, and it seemed to them, from what I could tell, that this was a little bit different too, because it was important to me that they know that I wasn't just parachuting in and then taking off, that I was invested in this project and that it was important to me as well. And so when they started to recognize that it was important to me, they then started to buy into that as well and then invest as well. I would go to each corner and made sure I went to every single person that was working at that time during those months that I was doing the shooting part, and set up in a shady spot with a little backdrop of white so that everybody was the same. And I, you know, would just talk to them a little bit and tell them what I was doing. I would show them I was in the art magazine. So just to show them that I was legitimate. And, you know, I used to teach at Winston-Salem State as well. And so I would say that and try to, you know, make them a little bit at ease. And then some of the guys would only have to go once. And they, you know, I could tell they were starting to get antsy. I wouldn't tell them to do anything in particular, really. And I'd shoot off as many as I could and then take them home, put them on the computer, and then I would sort of go through a process of looking at each one and seeing which one really spoke to me. And there was always one, never mind if I took three of that guy or if I went back three or four times, which I did with some of them. You know, because I just didn't get it. I didn't get it. I didn't get it. And I can't really tell you what it is I was looking to
get. Darn it, that's exactly what I'm getting at.
But I know that I got it. And part of it wasn't just the picture. It was all of the process of what came, of the layers that came technically after.
Sure. It was interesting to me looking at one of the ones that hit me right off the bat was the first one on your website, which is actually the fellow's got his back turned to you.
That's one of the first pictures I took. I love that photo.
It's really
he's
it's
not
striking.
Here anymore, unfortunately. He's gone back to Florida. His name is Chris. Yeah.
Oh.
You know, and I took some from the front. I mean, he had three fingers on each hand as well. And so, you know, but that wasn't nearly as interesting to me as the detail and the beauty. I have a thing for the nape of the neck as well, I have to say.
That's all right.
A little fetish about it.
Fine,
I love
fine.
The sort of the nape of people's necks from the back. And so just for no reason, I just said, you know, turn around. Like, can we just do some, just turn your head. And I had, of course, nothing except my own gut feeling about something.
Yeah.
It's consistently, it's one of the first ones I took, and it's all through the whole series been one of the favorite ones that I've done.
Yeah, now I can see where you're up against in terms of putting into words what it is about that that just kind of grabs you.
Well, I mean, conceptually, I mean, it's all about sort of the invisibility of these men. You know, do we see them, you know, and how you look closer almost when you can't see someone's face. You look at all the detail on their back. He also has an extremely sculptural quality to his very elegant long neck. There's something extremely regal about that photo. And yeah, he was lovely and very mild-mannered and very shy. I liked him a lot.
I'm just trying to get at what is so kind of heartwarming and nostalgic about that scene when I see Greg or whomever on the chit-chatting with somebody who maybe someone they've sold papers to before the light turns green.
Mm-hmm.
I've never heard anybody honk, like move along.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if they're tapping into the same sorts of feelings I'm getting.
Things start occurring to me about the work much, 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 much later.
Mm.
And so recently I was talking to Kenny Ray, who is one of my main sort of guys at Five Points that I've been working with quite closely and who's going to be playing the African kalimba at the opening.
And he's a hawker?
Yes.
Okay.
He has been there a very long time. And I was saying how it's interesting that you guys kind of geographically tie the city together in a way. And also, you know, with so many people who are on their phones and texting and cell phoning and so forth, you know, in general and in their cars, that it's like this moment that you just remind yourself to speak to another person kindly, and it doesn't cost you anything. Hi, how are you? And, oh, are you having a good day? And just a little, like you said, a little chit-chat, and it's a real gift. And they see it as a gift as well, just that, you know, a reminder that we are human beings and we need to have a physical interaction once in a while, and we could go through days without having any and think that we are connected. And yet that's probably why those kinds of incidents are so satisfying to people, because they don't realize how lacking maybe that the way we live is in terms of human connection, and that even if it's with someone you don't have anything necessarily in common with, we have a human connection always, and it's enduring. And so I think their presence is always a reminder, you know that he's coming up to your car and you roll your window down and you're about to have an interaction. I think that's kind of a beautiful thing.
Part 1 of my conversation with artist Christine Kerouac. Papermen, the series of 20 large-format black-and-white images of the hawkers who sell the local Winston-Salem Journal in the city streets, comes to the Delta Arts Center at 6 o'clock on Sunday night, May 20th, and it'll run through June 20th. The opening reception on Sunday will feature live kalimba performance and visits by several of the papermen themselves. You'll find links to images from Papermen, more information on the exhibit, and how you can support this remarkable project on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. On Wednesday, May 23rd, from 5:30 to 6:30, Green Hills Center for North Carolina Art will present a conversation between acclaimed Oak Ridge artist and Guilford College professor Roy Nydorf and Mount Holyoke Mellon professor of English, author, poet Chris Benfey. Their subject will be Four Decades, the first major survey of Roy Nydorf's work. The remarkable exhibit, including Roy's drawings, prints, paintings, and sculpture, will remain on display at Green Hill through June 10th. You'll find links to more information at wfdd.org/triadarts. Last week, Roy stopped by WFDD to look back on his work and forward to his next artistic challenge. When did you do Young Boy? When you were a teenager?
The self-portrait at the beginning of the show? Probably 19, maybe 20.
To have the patience then to get into the minutiae of those lines,
right,
hundreds of thousands of them, that's not the easiest stuff to tackle.
No, it's not. And sometimes I wonder why I do things that are kind of resistant or difficult. And I guess it's just an obstacle that I like to accomplish getting over.
Hmm.
The etching process, yeah, you have to work in reverse. You have to work backwards. You don't really know what it looks like until you print it. There's a lot of guesswork. There's a little bit of alchemy with the etching process and the acid. And, you know, yes, it can be risky, and so is subtractive sculpture. Very, very risky. You can't go back. I mean, once you cut it away, it's gone. So I guess I like walking that edge.
Jumping from that then to these paintings, some of the oils or acrylics you've got, I'm looking at Two New Haven Youths from 76, Seated Man with a green background,
yes.
77. At the core, I see Roy in all this work, regardless of medium, but very different approach and broad mm-hmm. brush strokes and lots of color and going from one to the other. I mean, what's that experience, that shift like from you as the artist, as you're working your way through?
Well, the shift is actually more gradual than it might appear. For instance, those early paintings you're referring to were painted from life. I had models in my studio. I was looking at them. I was observing. I was recording. But I was also open to change. I would often incorporate change, whether they changed the gesture or clothing or I changed. So that was happening then as it is now. But I kind of move in and out of realism as a mode. And I think since those early works, I've embraced more imaginative kinds of things and more decorative arts influence in my work than just straightforward realism or Baroque kind of approaches to painting.
Of those many mediums, we're talking about drawing and printmaking, painting, sculpture,
yeah.
Which presents the biggest challenges to you today? Forgetting at that human experience and layers of meaning, and I guess how do you overcome them?
The wood carving or sculpture has predominated my art practice in really the last 10 or 12 years. And I've been moving to a larger scale. I've got a piece in the show that's about 10 and a half feet long. It's called Tree Creature. It's like basically a tree that I fabricated into some mythic being with seven hands and a couple of feet. So the challenge really is going larger than holding something in my lap or in my hands and working it in a much bigger way where it's heavy, where I sometimes need another pair of hands to actually turn it. And also just attaching things, joinery techniques that I'm learning all by myself. I never really was taught these kinds of things. I'm kind of a self-taught carver, actually. It's also very slow, and sometimes there's a tremendous amount of resistance. The hardness of it, the physicality of hacking away at something or pounding at something or whatever it takes just physically to manipulate this kind of thing.
Can you talk me through that mental process? I can't think in reverse that way. I mean, I admire sculptors, but, you know, releasing the object from within, you know, right. Be it marble or, you know, in this case, wood. How do you maintain your confidence through that whole process that it's going to really be there?
Well, I draw a lot on the material. And my first carvings were actually done from blocks, just kind of generic blocks where I didn't really look into the material and see anything necessarily. I just would have a plan, so to speak. But as I've progressed, I guess, I like picking up on the random elements of either the shape of a piece of wood, how it was sawn, what the branch structure is, maybe the grain. And then I look for things, and sometimes I see them right away and then try to coax them out. So sometimes it's not really a big leap to see something in the wood and then just refine it. And other times, I guess one could say, wow, where did that come from? And maybe I did have more of a plan.
Roy Nydorf, 4 decades, opens May 23rd at Greenhill Center for North Carolina Art. Well, that's all for today's program. You'll find podcasts and archived episodes of Triad Arts Weekend on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. Please send your questions, comments, and suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.